This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Later this hour, WGCU's Mike Kanair will sit down with Mustafa Aykul. He is a senior fellow on Islam and modernity at the Cato Institute, and they'll be discussing his upcoming lecture at Florida Gulf Coast University called Islam Without Extremes, a Muslim Case for Freedom and Tolerance. But first, last night, hundreds of people gathered at the Broadway Palm Dinner Theater in Fort Myers to hear from a panel of experts on various aspects of the many water quality issues that we're facing here in Southwest Florida. It will come as a surprise to nobody that we're in the midst of a serious crisis when it comes to our waterways. The offshore red tide bloom still persists in some places, and it has been for more than a year now. And while the thick green cyanobacteria is no longer choking the Caloosahatchee River and its estuary, it's still present in Lake Okeechobee and could return to the river if the right conditions were to occur. Both of these harmful algal blooms have caused devastation, both environmental and economic, and there is currently no reason to believe that they're just going to go away. So while last night's panel discussion and audience Q&A was presented for members of the public, its real audience was newly elected officials on the local, state, and federal level who can actually do something to change the equation. Joining me now to discuss what happened last night and what's being proposed going forward is biologist John Cassani from Calusa Waterkeeper. John, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Julie.
I'm also joined by Marissa Carozzo. She is the Senior Environmental Policy Specialist at the Conservancy of Southwest Florida. Marissa, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And last but not least, we're joined by Captain Daniel Andrews. He's the co-founder of the advocacy group Captains for Clean Water. Captain Daniel, welcome back to Gulf Coast Live.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Did you attend last night's summit, or do you have a question or comment for our guests? As always, if you'd like to add your voice to our discussion, give us a call now at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCO. So, John, let me ask you first, how did last night go?
Hey, it went really good. This was the third in a series of our town hall meetings trying to engage people on these really important water quality issues. You know, had a good turnout, had excellent panelists. So I think it was a success.
How much audience feedback were you getting while you were there?
Yeah, we had some pretty good dialogue and some really good questions. A lot of people thirsty for information, a lot of passion on this issue. So, yeah, we did get some good dialogue, and I think it was useful.
Does it surprise you that people have maintained interest in this for as long as they have?
Yeah, a little bit, particularly on the public health issues. I had a lady engage me right after the meeting and just so concerned about her ongoing illness and how it may be related to the water quality issue. And it turns out there's dozens and dozens of people out there with those concerns. So, yeah.
So did any elected officials attend last night?
Yeah, I think we had one or two. Yeah, absolutely.
So are you going to have maybe a distillation of what was discussed that's forwarded on to elected official people so that they can do something?
Yeah, the voices are many, not just from us and from this event, but I think everyone that was there that has a concern is going to engage the legislature, local government. So it'll be many voices, I think, in response. Yeah.
Marissa, I'm going to ask you because you're the policy person for the Conservancy of Southwest Florida. How exactly do elected officials shape their policy decisions? Do they listen to groups like yours and events like this?
Yes, I think they do, especially when we have this level of community involvement and engagement in the issue. Our communities are looking for answers, looking for decisive action on improving our water quality. And as John mentioned, you know, we are seeing a level of interest beyond just the first few months of experiencing harmful algal blooms, that this has gone on for a long period of time. People still want to see that change, and they are letting their elected officials, whether it's at the local, state, or federal levels, know that they want to see these policy reforms. And our goals are in alignment with that. We want to continue to have that dialogue and push for those reforms.
So speaking of policy, apparently there's going to be some money directed to trying to find these solutions. Daniel Andrews, you were there when Governor Ron DeSantis came down to Bonita Springs to pledge $2.5 billion, with a B, dollars towards the water solution. How did it feel being part of that event?
Well, I think, it was great to be there. It was great to see that the governor's bold vision for what he wants to see happen in the environment. But it's, I think more than anything, it's what's needed. I wasn't surprised to see 200, 300 people there last night. And that's something that we're going to continue to see a lot of stakeholders engaged because of what happened in the community. I mean, these people faced a crisis this year. Many people had to, you know, close their businesses up, lay off workers. This is something that's impacted our barrier islands more so than many of the serious hurricanes that have came through this area. So that's something that our elected officials can't ignore. They can't continue to kick the can down the road with that. And they need to see that, you know, when all these leaders, the Chamber of Commerce organizations, have made it their number one priority to see action here, that's something that can't be ignored, and they have to take action on it now.
Yeah. Marissa, were you surprised by the announcement that came? It was 48 hours after Governor DeSantis was sworn in as the governor, and all of a sudden we have this executive order talking about $2.5 billion. An Office of Science, the chief science officer, is apparently part of this. There's a lot contained in that executive order. Were you surprised by some of the things that you saw there?
Well, I think it's an indication of just how critical and important these issues are, that 48 hours after the inauguration, he issued this executive order. And we really have the opportunity to help push those policy reforms forward, both at, you know, with working with the governor and the new administration, as well as the legislature, to ensure that they are able to be accomplished.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised. I mean, you don't really never know what to expect. But, I mean, just that was such a quick turnaround. And that's a lot of money. John Cassani, I want to ask you, do you think that $2.5 billion is going to put much of a dent in things?
Great question. The way I look at it is you have to look at the cost to the regional economies. And from all calculations, full cost accounting, it looks like there might be a $1 to $2 billion a year cost as a result of these harmful algal blooms. So you look at tourism, you look at real estate, property values, public health issues. We think it's actually a bit of a drop in the bucket in terms of what we really need to do. Be happy to get it. But we know how hard it might be to get all that from the legislature, but we're going to support that all the way.
And of course, you don't want to sit there and sound ungrateful either, too. You know?
I'm so grateful for even the implication that we could get that much. But we have to. There really is no other choice. We have to get that level of funding to bring back enforcement, to support these water quality policies by the state. Even local governments need some help in terms of trying to implement some of the state mandates and so forth.
Mm-hmm. You've been fighting this fight for a long time, for quite some time. And I think I remember last time that you were in here, it was kind of a rough day. I mean, I could tell that you seemed like kind of down and almost a little – do you feel a little different now?
Yeah. It's almost like the governor and other special interests were actually listening to us the past 6 or 8 months. I know my two colleagues here probably feel the same way. And when we read that list of initiatives, it was, oh, my God, this is really a vindication of what we've been talking about. Things we've been talking about since 2005, like a water quality component for the C-43 reservoir. And here it is. The governor has it front and center, wants to do it. So we want to see the legislature follow through and do these things.
It's kind of funny. It's like, okay, I'm done. Somebody heard me and they're actually going to probably do something about it. It's got to be kind of exciting for you guys. I'm kind of glad to be able to sit down and talk with you all since that occurred. So, but Marissa, the governor is saying that he wants these things to happen. This is an executive order, but does that mean that it's really going to happen? John alluded to it just a minute ago. He has to get the legislature to back him. How likely do you feel like that's going to be this legislative session?
Well, I think that that's part of our job, is to help push the legislature in the direction that the governor is going as well. I think in certain instances, it's going to be easier than others. And we have this outline that the governor has given us, and the priorities align very well with many of the initiatives, like John mentioned, the C-43 water quality treatment component, expediting the Everglades Agricultural Area Reservoir, and a number of other issues. So I think that we have this opportunity over the next couple of months, and we're going to be pushing as hard as we can for those.
So as far as policy recommendations, since that was the main reason that y'all were there last night, where do you start? At the very hyper-local level, city, county, what kind of things need to happen in that arena?
I'll go ahead with that first because there's actually a meeting coming up on February 5th being held by Collier County. It's a workshop on fertilizer ordinances. And so one of the low-hanging fruit, so to speak, of things that we can do on the local level quickly is strengthening our local fertilizer ordinances. And, for example, Collier County and City of Naples do not have a ban on the application of fertilizer during the rainy season. And that would be a local fix, something that we can do right now to improve water quality in Southwest Florida.
Okay. So on the local level, you're looking mm-hmm. for local ordinances to look at the overuse or use of fertilizers. How enforceable are those? I'm kind of curious.
Well, the ordinances should be enforceable, whether or not that's always happening is another question. With the level of nutrient pollution that we have in our local waterways, we can definitely be doing better and doing more enforcement actions. And part of that is education. Part of that is making sure that our residents as well as the fertilizer applicators understand the process. And it's also holding folks accountable when things are not going as they should.
Also, just the education anyway, just getting mm-hmm. it out there and letting people know that that could be having something to do with this, that science is kind of looking that direction, mm-hmm. might make people just want to, you know, reel it in a little on the fertilizer use.
Right. And if folks want to get involved and come to that meeting, that's going to be on February 5th. We don't know the exact time of it yet, but if you check conservancy.org, we'll be posting.
All right. Sounds good. And John, on the state level, you mentioned earlier the C43 water quality component. Tell me a little bit more about that, because when we're in it and reporting it all the time, it's in the back of our minds. But for the listeners that might not.
Yeah, the C43 is one of those state-federal partnerships. It was really intended as a hydrologic restoration project. The problem is it's been in the planning phase for so long, and water quality has subsequently gotten so bad that it's now dominating how the operation of the project could occur. So without a water quality treatment, and I think it's the only storage reservoir that does not currently have a water quality treatment component planned. So we think that's important. We've been asking for it since 2005. Really, the two signature issues that we had, the two big asks or the big ask that we wanted from this round of the legislature was the HAB task force, Harmful Algal Bloom Task Force. And it looks like the governor may be proposing two task forces, mm-hmm. one for dedicated to red tide and the other more specifically for blue-green algae. So we're pretty happy about that. Bring some science back to the policy part of that. Desperately need that. We need uniform protocols for public health notice, for testing, to prioritize certain water bodies for more monitoring. That's what we're really hoping for in that context. So we're happy about that.
Yeah. And interestingly, speaking to some of the people that came up with questions for you, there seems to be also in that executive order a little bit more information about getting the health department involved and looking at the health implications of all of this algae.
Yeah, the interagency cooperation thing has got to improve. It was a huge almost chaotic situation this past summer, one agency pointing fingers at the other. And FDOH is really kind of at the heart of that. So we need to see some real basic new protocols, some reform with that agency for sure.
If you're just joining the show, I'm talking with Marissa Carozo from the Conservancy of Southwest Florida, John Cassani from the Colusa Waterkeeper, and Captain Daniel Andrews from Captains for Clean Water. All three participated in last night's first ever Florida Water Policy Summit held at Broadway Palm Dinner Theater in Fort Myers. We're going over what was proposed in the way of actionable policy recommendations that will help restore our ailing water systems. If you'd like to make a comment or ask a question, give us a call. The number is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. And we do have a caller on the line. This is Morgan from Fort Myers. Sorry your call dropped off earlier, but I'm glad to have you on the air. What would you like to ask about?
Yeah, thank you. So I'm from Maryland originally, and I know that state through my entire, you know, elementary, high school, you know, career, college career. They were going through what was called Save the Bay, which ended up being a multiple state effort in improving the water quality of one of the most, complex estuary systems in the world called the Chesapeake Bay. And I was wondering if there's any effort, and I see no discussion on things like one of the primary items that they've done, which was called buffer laws or buffer zone laws, where they have construction, agriculture rules and regulations that resolved or revolved around these buffer zones that didn't allow, you know, for instance, seawalls and other things like tilling over stream systems for agriculture. They had all these very basic rules in place to protect buffer zones. And I'm wondering if there's any consideration from any of these parties to actually communicate with the states that have already been doing this for decades.
Okay, thank you. We'll get your the answer to that offline. John, I think I saw you nodding a little bit.
Yeah, I think the concept of riparian buffers has always been out there, and it's important. And I think we have some local planning initiatives that particularly the comp plans and the land development codes, they do require buffers to some extent. And it really comes down to whether we're enforcing those or not. And, you know, sometimes they don't – they just don't get implemented the way they were intended. So, yes, the answer is we have looked at it. They do exist in some context, but we could do a better job of widening those buffers. I think for some areas, particularly impaired waters, the buffer is only required to be like 20 feet, something like that. So we need better criteria.
And Marissa, is there much in the way of looking to other states that have bay issues or that have estuary situations that they've dealt with? I mean, does the Conservancy look at what other states have done to kind of model or, you know, just get some ideas?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Chesapeake Bay is certainly a model for restoring estuarine watersheds. And the Conservancy publishes an estuaries report card every 5 years or so to kind of look at the health of our estuaries in Southwest Florida. And, you know, what we've found over the, you know, the three report cards that we've published is that we are seriously suffering from a lot of different water quality problems, especially. So the goal is, you know, through that publication is to, you know, not just point out the problems, but point out solutions, things that can be done at the policy or the project level to improve water quality. And I think that, you know, one of the things that we were talking about last night is also updating stormwater standards. So that can get to some of the urban runoff in addition to fertilizer ordinances. We've known that the stormwater standards for development and new development in Florida have been outdated. We've known this for over a decade. And that the traditional types of treatments, like stormwater ponds within developments, are only removing somewhere between 40% and 70% of the pollution being generated on these properties. So what we need are better criteria and in our new development standards in order to ensure that we're not adding to additional loading because, you know, Florida is continuing to grow. You know, every day we're seeing new developments, we're seeing more people, and the more we grow and if we're using outdated standards, we're falling farther and farther behind.
So we got a comment on Facebook from Courtney Frazier. She says, I'm curious about Governor Ron DeSantis's request that the Water Management Board step down and resign. Many are refusing, and I wonder if there is a way to force them. I've wondered about this one. I don't know if anybody in the room knows about this, but I looked it up. I couldn't find anything. I found that some of the South Florida Water Management Board of Directors members, they did step down. Then some said that they were not planning to. Do you know anything about that?
So, yeah, that's a great question. And I'm not an attorney, so this is
neither am I. So I've just been poking around Googling it, and I'm getting nowhere.
Yeah, so it's my understanding that if the governor got in to try to push them out, that the Senate could be involved with, you know, confirming that they leave. That being said, though, you know, they've done that was a big step for the governor that really, you know, caught the attention of a lot of us that have been at this fight for a while. And he kind of showed he was serious by making that move.
Can you give for listeners who may not have been following this like you, could you give a little bit of the background on that? The South Florida Water Management District and then the governor asking him to step down?
Sure. So the Water Management District has been they're one of the agencies that are tasked with taking the lead on Everglades restoration. And as an outsider who's had to attend those meetings for the last 3 years now, there's been zero confidence from the public that they were doing that job. They always favored special interests, and that really came to a head at the November governing board meeting when they added an agenda item to renew a lease for 8 years to Florida Crystals. They added this agenda item at 9 p.m. the night before the meeting and didn't make any of these documents public. We showed up to the meeting with dozens of other environmental organizations all asking that this please be delayed. It wasn't. They voted unanimously except for the one governing board member who abstained due to him being an attorney for New Hope Sugar. He abstained from the vote, which, you know, that in and itself is a conflict of interest. He never should have been on the board to begin with. So that was, you know, really and you know, Governor DeSantis had asked them, you know, 2 days after he was elected, you know, November, the second week in November, that Thursday, he asked them to abstain from the vote. Congressman Mast drove down there and asked them to abstain. They didn't listen. So it's just a kind of a highlight of taxation without representation. You know, this agency is tasked with spending $750 million of our dollars every year, and they're not listening to the public whatsoever. So that's something that you know, a lot of organizations have called for that resignation, and then you know, those calls were echoed by the governor.
So if they decide not to, if they say I'm not going to put in my resignation, then from what you're hearing in the circles that you're talking about, it sounds like the legislature has to get involved.
It's my understanding that the Senate would be involved with that, but you know, it's. As the last I heard, several of the governing board members they were saying they wanted a chance to talk to the governor. You know, I think the governor's made it pretty clear he wanted, you know, a chance for them to leave, and he gave them that opportunity. So I'm hoping that they'll get their chance to talk to him and they'll part after that.
I have found throughout this entire saga for the past year, year and a half actually. Well, it's been going on for years and years and years. But this saga, and just in this critical last year or so, I have found your story to be really intriguing and interesting. The Captains for Clean Water, and that seems to be an organization that's managed to pull from all political sides and kind of be in the center of it, talking from a way, it seems like the statement is, we're not scientists and we're not pretending to be scientists and we're captains and we want somebody to fix it so we can get back on the water.
Yeah. I mean, there was, you know, deliberate damage being done to our offices, which are critical to the entire economy of South Florida. And that's, you know, that was unacceptable.
Your office is your boat.
Yeah,
out on the water.
The water. I mean, it'd be like if somebody came into this recording studio and started tearing down all your soundproofing stuff and damaged your microphones and computer, you'd be pretty angry and you'd want to see that fixed. You wouldn't ask them to do it less. You would say, stop doing that. This is not, you know, this is not how this is supposed to function. And, you know, when I started getting involved with these, you know, going to these meetings and seeing that, you know, they're giving each other awards, you know, at the Water Management District and, you know, patting each other on the back, talking about all the great work and all this money they're spending on all these projects. You know, they weren't looking at it from a business perspective, though. You know, if I was a fishing guide and my outboard motor blew up, you know, it's I've got two options. I either, you know, buy $15,000 for a new outboard or I don't fix it and then I can't pay my mortgage or my truck payment and I'm out of business. And they're not looking at that. They're looking, you know, when they find themselves in that situation, they're trying to spend the $15,000 on, you know, new GPS and new wheels for the trailer and, you know, everything other than what's actually going to fix the problem because it's politically contentious. And, you know, we see through that. You know, when you're out on the water and these decisions that are being made by policymakers are directly affecting your quality of life and, you know, you see the trickle-down effect throughout the economy. When you see decisions made where let's just, you know, spend this money so, you know, it looks like we're doing something, but we're not going to get to the, you know, the meat and potatoes of how we actually fix the problem, it doesn't give you a whole lot of faith, you know, that the problem's going to get fixed. And that's where we were at 3 years ago. We show up to these meetings and they were patting themselves on the back for, you know, spending $200 million on this or, you know, a couple hundred million on that. But the water was worse than it was the year before. And that's really the bottom line. That's the metric that we should be looking at. You know, here's the problem. We know what it's going to take to fix it. How much is that going to cost? And let's not put money on a bunch of other projects when the important ones aren't getting funded. So
I'd heard that before too. Marissa, what do you – when you hear that, you're kind of nodding. Everybody in the room is kind of nodding along. What do you think when you hear this?
Well, I think that with the level of engagement that we're seeing from the captains group, from all of the organizations who are involved in this issue, we're seeing change. And we need to see that change because we can't keep the status quo. It's not working.
Yeah. And John, as we mentioned before, you've been doing this for a while. Do you feel like this might be the time that we have finally reached that point where we have the political will to actually do something?
Yeah. As they say on the X-Files, I want to believe. I really want to believe. And
well, I'm from Missouri, so it's the show me state too. So
I'm thinking this is it. You know, this is that one time in your advocacy career that perhaps things will sincerely change and reform for the better to bring some balance back to these policies. So it's not just flood control and water supply. We're desperately in need of it, and we're desperately looking forward to it.
For a comprehensive solution.
Absolutely.
We have another caller on the line. This is Jim from Naples who has a question. Jim, what would you like to ask?
Hi, I want to talk about a bigger issue, which is climate change. And, I mean, some people don't even believe in it, but we know that red tide loves warm water. And with the Gulf water continuing to heat up, can we look forward to more intense and longer lasting red tide blooms?
That's a good question, and I think that's one that we've had a lot of scientists on this show trying to address all the different ingredients that create a good soup of red tide out there, or actually I should say a bad soup. John, what do you think? I mean, do you think it's possible to get ahead of this when climate change is where it's at and the waters continue to warm?
Yeah, it was a good question, and it's a well-recognized phenomena now. We're seeing it in Lake Erie. We're seeing it in other states around the country. 2018 was the hottest year ever recorded on record, and we're finding that these harmful algal species really become better competitors when the water is warmer. So it's no surprise to see that. Of the six longest documented red tide blooms, three have occurred since 2002. So they're becoming they're lasting longer, they're happening more often, and they're more severe in terms of cell density. So something's happening. The underlying cause, many think, the two underlying causes is warming water and nutrient enrichment, those two things.
Mm-hmm. And I understand, did Dr. Bill Mitch come to the event last night?
He did.
That he was a late arrival. He was announced on the Facebook page that he was going to be there. Can you summarize a little bit of what he talked about?
Well, he's got his wet culture concept, and it looks really interesting where you rotate crops to wetlands and back and forth, trying to get rid of the legacy nutrients. So that's something really important to try to address the legacy nutrient problem, which is an insidious problem here in Florida, especially the big lakes like Lake Okeechobee. Some of the back bays have terrible legacy nutrient problems.
Mm-hmm. We have another question coming from Richard in Fort Myers. Richard, what would you like to ask about?
Yes, ma'am. I have a question regarding, is this a legacy that Governor Scott has left us and his inaction and the just sort of the impunity with which the board operated? I had phoned in previously regarding a question I had regarding who was on the board. And what were their names? You know, who were they? Apparently, they had immense power to actually reduce the size of the project with just no one having any other input except for them, and they were a volunteer board.
Yeah, it was an appointed board.
And they had absolute power. Pardon?
Yeah, it was an appointed board. Does anybody want to the question that you were going to ask was?
Yeah, the question I was going to ask was, is this a reflection of what we have to expect from Governor Scott, now Senator Scott, in the future regarding legislature and legislating environmental issues?
All right, Richard. Thanks for your question and comments.
I would just add that I don't see it being very productive to look back now and to dig up some of that stuff. I mean, to some degree, I think we've learned from the mistakes of the past. I hope we have. And I think the governor's new executive order is a symptom or an expression of what we've learned from the past. So I just want to look forward and try to fix some of these problems as soon as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'll add to that, you know, I think that was a great point, John. But it really shows the power of those seats, you know, what we're seeing right now. You know, we've got a governor now that's demanding resignations and they're refusing. They've called themselves a volunteer board, but honestly, they're probably 9 of the most powerful individuals in the state because they're controlling the water. Whoever controls the water has the power. So that's, you know, we have not had a you know, great response from that governing board in the past. You know, in our 3 years of existence, there has not been one time where we've gone up there and commented at a public meeting when they've changed their mind on the issue. They always just – they make their mind up in advance and go forward and do it. But after, you know, witnessing, you know, how all this political process unfolds and then seeing the crisis we had this summer, I think where we're at now is how that board's been operating is absolutely intolerable. We're not going to deal with it anymore. The new governor said he's not going to deal with it anymore. And moving forward, we need representation from the communities that are actually affected by those decisions that board makes. You know, it costs this area, Southwest Florida, you know, tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars this year, possibly into the billions. We don't know. Those impacts are still being totaled. But again, you know, hindsight's 20/20. But moving forward, we can't have special interests that are, you know, holding on to the powers of that board.
We have another comment that came in on Twitter, I believe it was. With Governor Ron DeSantis's commendable actions, why haven't we heard his position on phosphate mining and its devastation of Florida? His transition team member, Elaine Stewart, is a former VP Government Affairs of Mosaic, and that leaves him skeptical. Was there any discussion last night at the policy forum that you had about anything on phosphate mining? Did that come up?
Yeah, not too much. There was a mention or two. It's a significant issue in the greater Charlotte Harbor watershed, which does influence Pine Island Sound, Mattleshay Pass. And boy, those are some really entrenched issues. I know there's some litigation pending on some of those things. Some of those internal counties kind of look to phosphate as, hey, job producer. But when you look at full cost accounting, the picture doesn't quite look so good anymore, especially as we're polluting downstream watersheds in a big way. So you have to look at all those costs and all those impacts to really fully assess it. So it was an issue, and we did talk about it just a little bit.
Just a little bit. And Marissa, I was going to ask the Conservancy of Southwest Florida, do they have any kind of position on phosphate mining?
Because it's generally out of our five-county regional
Your
focus,
jurisdiction.
We don't generally get involved on those issues.
I wanted to ask all of you guys before we run out of time, I wanted to ask just one last quick question. That would be, do you feel like the public is going to be able to remain engaged on this topic long enough to make a difference long term? That's for all you guys.
Well, I would just add that I took the grandkids out to the Coosahatchee River for a fishing trip last Sunday. Cyanobacteria is still here. It's still in the freshwater reach of the river, and I think it's just a matter of time before the water heats up enough. It'll be back. So we've had these blooms, massive historic blooms, two of the last 3 years. And if you look a little further back, the year 2000, that decade, we had 4 or 5 major blooms. So decades before, we don't remember this happening. So I think the problem is going to be out there in the public's view, affecting public health. I think they're going to stay engaged on it.
Mm-hmm. And I think based on the level of engagement we even saw last night, you know, around 200 people coming out to a policy-related talks on a Monday night, you know, not usually the most exciting topic ever.
Seriously, that's quite the turnout.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hey, we're going to talk about public policy. Would you like mm-hmm. to come? More than 200 people coming? That wouldn't have happened 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And throwing around MFLs, TMDLs, BMAPs, all the acronyms you can possibly think of. But this is where you make change at the policy level. And I think that that's getting people's attention. And if we can keep that engagement going, and I think with the help of the groups that are in this room, all the other ones who are engaged, you know, having broadcasts like this that keep it at the forefront of people's minds, we can keep this topic going and get the change that we need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm very optimistic. You know, after what happened here this summer, people became enraged. More people got involved with this issue than have been for decades. And once they started to see all the political corruption involved with it unfold right after this crisis, you know, and they're seeing, you know, these corrupt land lease deals and, you know, how deep it really all goes, that's the reason that Floridians have decided this is their number one issue across the state. And, you know, in our conversations at Captains for Clean Water with partners that are out of state, you know, cooler companies, Yeti coolers, apparel, you know, fishing tackle manufacturers, all these, you know, Mustad Hooks is involved with it, SeaDek, boat manufacturers, they're all fired up about this issue because their business suffered. And then they see, wait, why is stuff like this happening? Why are we renewing leases on land where we have critical projects? That's the stuff that really gets under people's skin. And you know, that's – the governor recognized that. You know, he's not from South Florida. He hadn't faced all these. But he, you know, looked down here and saw people are suffering. People are mad. And if anybody in the state of Florida wants any kind of political future, this is something they have to be in front of, because the days of, you know, dealing with lobbyists, getting all your information from special interests and avoiding the issue – That's not what Floridians want to see anymore. You know, this is costing us jobs. This is, you know, really hurting our quality of life, and they're over it. You could take it to the bank that's going to be why this issue gets fixed.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I want to thank my guest, John Cassani. He's a biologist with Colusa Waterkeeper. John, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Julie. Appreciate it.
Also, Marissa Carozzo from she's a senior environmental policy specialist with the Conservancy of Southwest Florida. Marissa, I appreciate your time as well.
Thank you.
And also, Captain Daniel Andrews is the co-founder of Captains for Clean Water. Daniels, I think thanks to you as well.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Hopefully get back out there on the water pretty soon.
Hope so.
When we return, we get a preview of the upcoming lecture being presented by Florida Gulf Coast University's Libertarian Philosophy Club, Eagles for Liberty, called Islam Without Extremes, a Muslim Case for Freedom and Tolerance. WGCU's Mike Anayri will sit down with Turkish writer and journalist Mustafa Akyol. He is a senior fellow on Islam and modernity at the Cato Institute and an opinion writer for The New York Times. I'm Julie Glenn, and you're listening to Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.